We're in our hotel room. We just returned from eating an Italian dinner on Russell Square, and we're really tired. We've been at this now a full day and sleeping fitfully and whatever. But everybody agrees it was an excellent trip, and the flight delay that we had was unavoidable. Now, what I wanted, and I want everybody to speak to, is first impressions of either the trip or London. And I'll give mine, and then I'll ask Ethan to give his. But my first impression was, this London is such a hurly-burly, busy, big, everybody going somewhere, crowded, fun, prosperous-looking city. It's really something for a little country boy like me coming out of Ellensburg to see this. And now, Ethan?
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite this busy with this many buildings. I mean, Seattle has got a lot of stuff, but it's kind of all centralized. London has a lot of stuff and spread out over acres.
And the cab driver told us, didn't he, that he thought the greater metropolitan population of London is 13 million people, which is like 26 downtown Seattle, so it's that big. Nanny, what do you have to contribute to this? Nanny will talk tomorrow. We had a smooth first day in London. First off, last night, during the night, we had one of the most hellacious thunder and lightning storms in the history of mankind. It thundered, it lightened, it woke everybody up, lit up the sky, rained like the dickens. But in any case, this morning, we took care of all our housekeeping, most of our housekeeping chores, like getting our underground tickets and going to the Houston station and getting the travel pass and all that business. And then after that, we went to Tower London. And we did the complete Tower of London, including crown jewels, ate some fish and chips, and we had, I think, a really successful day. We conquered the underground with not too much difficulty. We got the train business at least partly straightened up in our head. I think we had a good day, and we're ready for another big travel day tomorrow. I want to ask both Ethan and Margot their impressions of the day or what they saw that they really enjoyed. I chatted with both Ethan and Margot, and I pretty much have the sense of what they wanted to say. And it's that they just idolize me and everything I've done, and they can't wait to go traveling with me tomorrow. P.S. While we were at the Tower of London and waiting in lines to see the crown jewels, there happened to be a beef eater there, gray-haired and quite distinguished-looking and whatever. They're all retired British military people, I suppose, mostly Army, but in any case, he was wearing a United Nations Korean medal. A ribbon. And I said to him, just in passing, really, "Oh, I see you served in the Korean War." He said, "Yes, I did." He said, "I'm the last beef eater here. I'm the last beef eater who served in the Korean War." So he's the end of the line for that war. Which makes me, and I wondered a little bit later, that means then there are probably no World War II veterans who are beef eaters anymore. Margo and I are sitting at our supper table. We've just finished some nice lamb chops, orzo, Greek olives, and a really nice supper. But in any case, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and it was an excellent idea to sit in a hotel room at the end of every evening in London and reminisce and talk about the day's activities, but it really didn't work out. It was a good idea, but it didn't materialize, and mainly because by the time we were returned to our hotel room at night, we were just exhausted, or at least not ready to go talking into a tape machine. So it was a good idea, but we didn't do it. So maybe over the future time, maybe we can reminisce a little bit about London and something, because Mark and I have talked about it a lot, and we have lots of good memories, and maybe we can share these in the future. One of the games we played, the two of us played when we were children, you had to have a group of kids to play this game, was hide and go seek, and often played after supper when the dusk was settling in. And as I remember the game, is you'd pick a place often like a telephone pole, and then somehow or other we decided, I suppose we picked on the weakest member. That person was it. And they had to count, I think, to 100, although I think the counts to 100 sounded often like a tobacco auctioneer, you know, whatever you want, that kind of thing.
I think sometimes
they're
counted by five.
And then at the end of that, you were sort of required to say, and this is funny because Margot brought this up, and I haven't heard this just in, can't tell you how many years. Quote, all around by is it. And that was the thing, I guess if you were too close to home, I guess that was by, then you were caught and you had to do count to 100. Then what happened is this one person count to 100, and then everybody, all the other kids, would go hide not far away in alleys and behind cars and that kind of thing. And then the person had to go find them, as I remember, and then they had to run home to the telephone pole or whatever the place was, but that's what I remember playing, a telephone pole. And they would say, I found Johnny or something like that, and then Johnny would be it. But if the person went looking and then Mary could sneak home, she would go home and hit the telephone pole and she was home free, I think is what we said.
Yeah.
But this expression, all around by is it, is a really interesting expression. And I think it's the same one I used when I was a little kid, and I heard Margot say it, and I guess it's the same expression she used. I think it's really interesting over all these miles. And then, of course, being a college prof, I wonder, well, how old is that expression, and where does it start, and those kind of things. And, of course, right now I don't know. P.S. I think the point about hide-and-go-seek, the person counting 100, who was it, he didn't just stand and look at the telephone pole. He actually had to cover his eyes, you know, put his eyes in the crack of his arm, and he had to count 100 or cover his eyes in some way, so he couldn't see where people hid. But then you'd say, well, okay, we'll just stand behind him, and as soon as he uncovers his eyes, we'll slap the telephone pole and we'll say home free. And I think the all around by is it, is the idea that wasn't cricket. You couldn't play that devious kind of a game. You had to actually go out and hide. You couldn't stand behind a counter with his eyes closed, and then as soon as he said 100, you say home free. That was illegal. Footnote number 2. Last night, sleeping or half awake or something, I recalled a part of the tape we made earlier. I don't really remember now. We'll have to see a transcript of it in some way. But the question was, why on earth did I live in so many places when I was a kid? And I have now recalled, I think, two more places. And I tell you, I think I can actually think of perhaps 14 places I lived in by the time I was 17 years old. And this gets it down to, I don't know what, I figured it out, but it's like I moved on average every 13 months. And this is just crazy. And it just, honestly, it doesn't make any sense. And if we had the answer to that question, why on earth we were such a just wanderlust apartment to apartment, to house, I think it'd be an incredibly interesting, insightful fact. And I don't understand how we moved to, I mean, moving, you know, you move now with thousands of dollars. This is a real puzzle. Going back almost to the beginnings of photography, there were itinerant photographers in Europe and I said in the United States. The most famous one, perhaps, was Atjeh, who was a Parisian who went around Paris taking pictures. But I think most itinerant photographers took pictures of people. And I remember an itinerant photographer in Jersey City. He was and I can almost see him. I have a memory of him, a tall, older, maybe 50s or 60s. I think a German, and he had a big box, black wooden box camera on a tripod, and he went around for probably not a lot of money and went to the various neighborhoods. I don't think you call him up and he took pictures of you out in the street. And I know, in fact, there are some photographs around in somebody's shoebox somewhere, taken by this old fella. He'd come around and you'd pay him, I'm sure, not a lot of money. And he'd take some pictures and take them home and, you know, develop them and then bring them back a few days later and get us a couple of bucks or two. But certainly something you don't see anymore now, this idea of the itinerant photographer. And of course, there's a long history of itinerant artists in our country, and would go around and take pictures, paint pictures of farmers and their farmhouses and all that. And you don't see that anymore either. My grandmother on my mother's side owned and operated a candy store. That's what we call them. Candy stores were general stores. They sold newspapers and pop and cigarettes and candy and that kind of thing. When my brother and I visited Jersey City a couple of 3 years ago, certainly 3 years ago, the building was still there. We drove by it. It just, in the flesh, it was a little modest-sized yellow brick building, but it had been converted into a house where there had been a big store window that had been bricked in. In any case, not far from this candy store was, I guess, a water inlet, a bay, I suppose, and there was a broad expanse of kind of a sandy beach or whatever associated with this. My memory of it's sort of vague, but I think I have it about right. But what I saw there when I was a child was Italian men, and there were lots of Italians lived in Jersey City and probably still do. On some days, I don't know whether I suppose they did it on weekends, I don't remember the day, but they had greyhounds, and they went down to the beach, this broad expanse of beach, and with live rabbits or hares, I don't know which, I don't think I would have known then and can't remember now. And they let the hares go, and after the rabbit or hare or whatever it was got some distance, they turned their greyhounds loose on them to actually catch them and, of course, kill them. Really a cruel sport. But I remember seeing this from a distance, these men using greyhounds to hunt hares. And, of course, it was a cruel time. On garbage collecting, here in Ellensburg, the garbage is collected by once a week by a single man who drives, or one man, not a single man, one man who drives a truck. And he drives the truck, he stops, he jumps out of the cab, he runs up, gets the garbage, dumps it in, takes the can back, gets back in the cab and goes to the next. And he collects all, one guy collects all the garbage here in Ellensburg, or at least in my neighborhood. Now, when we, Margo and I lived in Dublin, they had garbage collection teams in the city, and they were six people. There was a driver, there was there were two people on either side of the street, two on one side, two on the other, and then there was a supervisor. So here you have six people collecting garbage in Dublin. We assume, probably, I'm sure correctly, that, you know, Ireland is a socialist country, and they have an employment problem, so they figured it's easier to hire six people than hire one or two, and then pay four people on welfare or whatever. But we thought it was incredible that they had six people. A footnote to that story, the garbage collectors actually, I don't know, I think they actually went on strike. And they went on strike because, and one of their things they wanted, they struck about is they, this is Dublin now, mind you, they didn't want to collect garbage in rain. They thought that was not right. Anyway, I don't remember how the suit came out. In any case, this garbage business comes up because I remember I don't remember how garbage was collected in Jersey City, but the story about my grandmother resurrects in my mind a story I can clearly remember. Horse-drawn, high-sided, gray, wooden, four-wheeled wagons, and they collected the garbage, at least down where my grandmother lived. I can't remember now whether they were two-teamed horses or a team or you know, four horses. But I remember the men, there were several men that worked these garbage trucks, wagons, and they were Italian. Now, I don't know, somebody told me they were, but I remember they were all short and very stocky and powerfully built. And I think somebody told me once the reason they were all Italian men was the fellow that owned the garbage collection business, the trash business, was himself an Italian. Implication, he was fixed up with maybe the mafia or the Black Hand and all of them. He would only hire Italian men to collect the garbage. At least that's a story that I can recollect. Horse story. This summer of 97, when we went to London, we visited a truly fun museum. It was the British London Transport Museum, and it was really well done. They had all kinds of wagons and carts, and of course they've been hauling people in London for, you know, hundreds of years, so it was a great little museum. In any case, one of the little facts that they had in this museum was in the heyday of the horse-drawn trolley cars in London, they had 18,000 horses. Now think about how many horses that is, and think about how many people that is to haul the hay. What do you do with all the manure? How many horseshoers do you need? Do you have sick call for horses? How many veterinarians do you have? And certainly they had to be dying, and they had a lot of these figures were available, and I don't remember them, but they had like thousands of horses every year died. That makes sense, doesn't it? And then you have to, what do you do with like 2,500 dead horses, I think? And you think about that in every country. Take this garbage story I just told you about. I mean, how many horses did they have pulling these wagons, and, you know, where'd they get the hay, and who shooed them? And there's a whole story there, and I haven't any interesting, but I have no idea what it's all about. Final Italian story for tonight. I remember when I was a little guy, I don't remember how old I was, but we lived on Wilkinson Avenue, was the name of the street we lived on, in Jersey City, and I remember we lived in a near a neighborhood which was predominantly Italian. It was like several blocks away, but predominantly Italian. And I'll tell you a little strange little story that for some reason is always, when this strange little story sticks in your mind. I remember, now here I am like, I should try to really think how old I was, but 6 or 7 maybe, something like that, I don't remember. But walking along with a friend, and we pass another kid, another boy, and we pass by in front of a Italian grocery store. Now, hanging in the window, they had a metal band, and then they had metal hooks, and hanging on the down from these hooks were like bags of hard cheese. I suppose Parmesan or Gouda cheese or whatever. And I remember my friend sort of poking me in the ribs, and he said to me, "You see those bags there? That kind of these." And they were, I suppose, like, they looked like a kind of a balloon, I guess you'd say, and maybe 6 inches long or something like that, filled with white, looked like white cheese. He said, "You see those bags?" He said, "Do you know what? Italians use those to make babies." And I remember thinking as a kid, I thought about this for a while, and I thought, no, I don't know the mechanics of all this, but I just don't believe that those cheeses hanging in the window has anything to do with it. I'm not even sure I knew they were cheeses, but I looked at them and said, no, I doubted the story. So I've always been a kind of doubting Thomas. P.S., minor correction, I said Wilkinson Avenue, but actually that was Cater Avenue. And Cater Avenue, although the story remains the same, but I really was a young kid then, and that's where I got on Cater Avenue was where I got, at least once, because I think I got sick a couple of times, but I really, really got sick on Cater Avenue, and I think that was before Florida, so golly, I was just a little guy when that story happened. I was born in 1929, March the 11th. The New York World's Fair was 1939. So I went to the New York World's Fair. I don't remember who I went with. I just remember women. I don't really remember going with my father at all, but who knows who was there. And so I was 10, and my memory of it is rather vague. Except one really clear memory I have to write today, and it was I saw in the World's Fair television. I did see television, a sort of display of how it works, and the TV screen, it was quite little, about, I suppose, 6 or 8 inches, something like that. So actually, television, 1939, I did see it. I remember when the United States Army was completely segregated, where there were black units and there were white units. The officers in the black units were, however, white. They often were in truck companies, stevedore companies, that kind of servicing companies. They tended not to put blacks into the combat arm. I think that was changed by President Truman in 1948. I do think there was perhaps a black infantry division in World War II, but I'm fairly sure there was a black division, but that was, of course, disbanded after the war, and then they went back to the segregated thing. In the Navy, I don't know a lot about it, but I think the Navy was segregated more according to jobs, so that the only thing a black person could do in the Navy was like a steward or a mess boy or something like that. I don't think they did any of the combat roles, gunnery sergeant or radio operator or anything like that. P.S., there was no Air Force. The Air Force was part of the Army up until 1947, I think, or 48. And before that, they were called the Air Corps and was simply governed by the rules of the Army. In any case, it's after supper. Margo and I having a nice cup of green tea from China. We ordered yesterday a Bose disc playing player, a really nice one, from it's made in Massachusetts, I guess, and miracle of miracles, it was here this morning, late this morning, delivered. So it's just incredible they can get an object, 15-pound object like that across the United States in just a matter of hours. At least it's incredible to me. You think about, read some of the covered wagon stories, and you know, took months and months and months to go anywhere. So the other thing about the Bose player is I think we paid for this Bose player what we paid for a whole Volkswagen in 1954. I believe the price was exactly the same. In any case, today is the last day of September 1997. October, Halloween, lots of birthdays and the like. I want to go on record about certain things, so the date pins it down. I want to tell you the following things. The man of the century, the man of the millennium, the biggest problem we have facing us as a world, the second biggest problem we have facing us as a world, and the biggest scam I ever fell for. So, first off, and we'll do this with Margot if she wants to do it, or either today or tomorrow. But in any case, man of the century is going to be Roosevelt, President Roosevelt. Man of the millennium is going to be Jefferson, President Jefferson. So both the man of the century and man of the millennium will be Americans. Biggest problem we face as in the world today is population. I'm just absolutely convinced that's our single biggest problem, population. I think our second biggest population is degrading the environment, but it sort of goes hand in hand, doesn't it, with population. So, and not precisely so, but I think excess population just makes the taking care of the environment even harder and harder. And it seems to me maybe we're not doing a great job at this. The biggest scam was nuclear power. We were promised, everyone, the thinker supposedly envisioned, free power. There would be electricity at home would be absolutely free. It'd be perfectly safe. It'd be clean, it'd be non-polluting, it'd be forever. We would never have to worry about paying light bills or anything. We could have electric cars, and it would just be this wonderful, clean, safe, endless amount, inexhaustible power. And of course, it's just been the damnedest lie ever heaped on not just Americans, but everybody in the world. Margot wonders if really the man of the century is not Einstein instead of President Roosevelt. I think I said that that's an outstanding pick, but it's still not my pick. I think a funny little story. I went to my doctor today. His name is Solberg, and which I guess means Sun City. And in the course of our conversation, as we were talking, because, I had a cold and all that. Anyway, in any case, I said to him, when I was a child, I was treated for, I said guitar. I didn't know what it was. I thought that's how it was. Margot said, no, it's catarrh. In any case, Margot has looked this word up in the dictionary. I can't find it anywhere. We're not sure how it's spelled or anything. And I said to him, is there such an ailment anymore? Apparently he meant stuffy nose or something like that. I don't remember. I was only a little kid. And he said, no, nobody has that anymore. So,
okay, I got it.
Okay, Margot has it. Go.
It's C-A-T-A-R-R-H.
Okay.
Inflammation of mucous membranes, especially of the nose and throat.
Right. Now it seems to me that's really a good term. It seems people do have inflammations of the nose and throat. I certainly do. But they don't call it catarrh anymore. Where I first heard it, I have to tell you where I first heard this word, My godfather was McIntyre, Walter McIntyre, who was a counselor of law in New Jersey and later a judge. He had a friend who was an Orthodox, I think Orthodox, or certainly a very religious Jew named Goldberg. I think his name was Goldberg. And we went there to eat one night, and they lived, for me, living in Jersey City, they lived in, I thought, a palatial mansion, had this long table with candles and wine and all this stuff. And it was really pretty fancy. And his house was filled with servants, but they were all mentally challenged people. They were women. But he hired the handicapped way before that was popular. He's the fellow that diagnosed me of having the catarrh, or guitar, depending on your band. While I'm on the subject, I remember two things about this Dr. Goldberg. Thing one is he had in his home some young children. I think they were boys, but I'm pretty sure they were boys, young boys. And I don't know if everyone knows, but in World War II, they evacuated the cities of England, the big cities like London, because the Germans were bombing them, so they sent the kids out of the cities into the country and elsewhere. And I guess these children were Jewish children, and they actually sent them to this country. So they were from England. They were young Jewish English children who were evacuated, and he took them in. So they weren't orphans. They were just here while during World War II. I suppose this must have been, what, 1942 or somewhere like that, or something like that. The other story is, I have a vague memory. When this doctor was a young man, he went to med school, of course, and he had to study. And McIntyre told me he actually ruined his health by going to med school. He had no money, he was poor, he didn't eat properly, lived on an apple a day, that kind of thing. Actually, McIntyre told me that. And so it may be true. The other thing was, his parents, Goldberg's parents, were extremely Orthodox, and they would not allow him to study on the Sabbath. And of course, he felt he had to be studying around the clock to pass med school, and probably did. And so he would sneak off or whatever, hide in a closet or something like that.